Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, Athens-Clarke County Mayor Kelly Gertz joins us to review the last year and to talk about what he'd like to see local policymakers tackle in 2021.
So the challenging times continue. But what's good is that Athens has really been holding itself together.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Also today, we'll get the latest from under the Gold Dome as legislators get underway in what might be a very contentious session.
I do not believe that you can think you're going to passively get out of this pandemic. We have to take the test and the vaccine to the people.
Plus, an update from the UGA Center for the Ecology of Infectious Diseases, and the university celebrates the 60th anniversary of desegregation.
Those stories, our critic at large on notable local albums of 2020, and more. That's coming up on Athens News Matters.
Hours ago, halfway around the world, the day has already begun.
Tens of thousands of people in Venezuela.
Britain is leaving the European Union.
Everyone was just running. People were crying. They were in tears. And we didn't know what was happening. Police kept telling us to move back, move back.
The thousands of protesters marched along a route.
When you need to know where the world went while you weren't looking. Morning Edition. Listen every morning.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. The month of January is generally when leaders take stock and talk about the state of things. The State of the Union address is the most notable example, but there's also the governor's State of the State address earlier this week. But what about the state of the city? Here to give us a look at how Athens is doing is Athens-Clarke County Mayor Kelly Gertz. Welcome back to Athens News Matters.
Happy January, Chris.
Well, last year was an especially challenging one for everyone, and certainly for local government. Can you talk just in general about how Athens is doing right now in terms of this pandemic?
I mean, the good news is we have the lowest mortality rate from COVID of any metro center in the state. And that's also true relative to any of our neighbors. So the lowest mortality rate of any of our neighboring communities and any in the Atlanta metro area. And that's because people have just done the very simple, smart things. They've masked, they've stayed distant, and enough people have avoided crowds. Now, we know that that's not 100% true, and that's where some of the challenge lies right now.
Right.
And so I'm asking all of your listeners, double down on those simple, safe things, because we are right now in the midst of a caseload spike. We've been over 100% use in this region for our ICU beds.
Well, how about the local economy, which we know depends so heavily on the service industry? How are things going out there?
Certainly, those service industry and convention-focused businesses are hurting the most right now. There's no doubt. I'm very grateful for the federal aid that was passed in December and anticipating certainly more in really probably the first weeks of the Biden administration. That's going to be essential, again, particularly for those places where people love to gather. So I'm hopeful that what was branded as the Save Our Stages element of this most recent pandemic relief bill is really going to be meaningful for live music and other live performance venues, theaters, convention facilities, and the like. But we are able to kind of maintain pace as a community. Obviously, unemployment is up, but it's not up at the spiking levels that we saw last May and last June. So the challenging times continue, but what's good is that Athens has really been holding itself together. You know, we as a local government have delivered $2.1 million in grants to local businesses, nearly $1 million in loans. We will be approving this week some allocation of some community development block grant dollars that we've received from the federal government. We anticipate another delivery of those dollars that I think we are going to focus very specifically on unhoused persons in the community. And so there's a lot of work to be done, but I give enormous credit to everybody here, you know, pulling together, looking to see how people can help their neighbors and one another. That's how we're going to make it through these coming months.
Well, finally, what's ahead for Athens-Clark County in the year 2021, both in terms of the challenges the city faces, but also in an aspirational sense? What are the big tasks you want to see the commission take on this year?
I believe particularly when it comes to workforce development and upward mobility, we're going to be making some strides. We've been partnering with the school district and Athens Technical College and the university and others to ensure that as people make the transition into adulthood, that they do have some training and employment opportunities.
Right.
The Athens Community Corps that we kicked off just in the last 6 months has been part of that. I think we are going to continue to see an upswing in home ownership, particularly for those Black and brown and historically poor members of our community that were not situated to be able to build wealth in that way. That's in part through some of the dollars that that the citizens voted for through the SPLOST 2020 package. It's through some of the collaboration that we'll be able to do through the tax allocation districts that were rolled out and collaboration with the development community. So I feel very positively about those things. And I also feel very positively about really the employment base expanding. Next week, I'm going to be part of a ribbon cutting at the bioplant facility out on Old Monroe Road, just off Atlanta Highway, where there are going to be 200 high wage manufacturing jobs that will be a piece of the firmament of our employment sector here in the community. And we'll be seeing more of that later in the year.
Kelly Gertz is the mayor of Athens-Clark County. Thanks so much for stopping by Athens News Matters today.
Thank you, Chris. Stay safe.
District Attorney of the Western Judicial Circuit, Deborah Gonzalez, started her term with a sweeping slate of progressive reforms. The measures include new guidelines for charges, prosecution, and sentencing, including seeking diversions over incarceration when possible, and eliminating cash bail and other practices that penalize the poor, as well as no longer pursuing the death penalty. She joins us to talk about a few of the changes she's making and her plans for the delivery of justice. District Attorney Deborah Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely glad to be here.
Among your reforms is a promise to develop a data dashboard that will compile statistics on charges, convictions, and sentencing by race, gender, and other variables, and will be publicly available information. Can you tell us more about how this dashboard will work and where this idea came from?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I can't take all the credit for this idea. This is one of those best practices that I have been looking around the country, looking for how we can be much more transparent and accountable to the public. And it was just such a great, very easy one look. You get the information and you get sort of a snapshot of not just what crime looks like in your community, but also what is the DA's office and some of the decisions that are being made in the DA's office in one simple, easy to view and understand place.
You're also changing the way the court approaches marijuana possession. Could you walk us through some of those changes?
Yeah, and this is something, talked about for years, even when I was state rep and was voting against criminalization of marijuana. My approach does make a distinction between simple possession of marijuana for personal use versus possession of marijuana or any other drug for distribution. I just don't believe that somebody should be going to jail or they have their complete life ruined because they have a joint. However, if they have any intention of selling, well, that is activity that we will not condone and that we will prosecute. So I want to make that very, very clear. And the purpose of these kinds of things are, listen, resources, again, are scarce. I want to go after the really serious crimes, the crimes, murder, abuse of children and women, the things that are really considered safety concerns for our families. But different things, like you've got a joint, I don't think is really worth all of the effort and the money, the taxpaying money, to go after that scenario when we really should be devoting those to the serious cases.
Executions have been in the news recently as U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr is rushing a slate of federal executions before the end of President Trump's term. Of course, these are federal executions, not state. But could you tell us a little bit about your promise not to pursue the death penalty? This comes as a contrast to your predecessor, Ken Maldon, who sought the death penalty in a case as recently as 2011.
Yes, and this is another one where I have been, you know, completely out there as to that. I would not pursue the death penalty. In fact, I am co-author of an op-ed that came out this week with Fair and Just Prosecution about why we should not have executions. And we just had one this week of the first woman executed in almost 70 years. Did the crime she commit was horrendous? Yes. Do I believe that we have any right to take the life of another person? No. I think we have other alternatives, including life without parole, which is a very severe type of punishment, and to hold someone accountable. But, you know, one of the things that we've learned, unfortunately, is that new evidence does come up in some of these particular cases, and we find out that people have been put on death row who were actually innocent of the crime that they were accused of. And once you have an execution, you cannot go back. You cannot say, oops, sorry, you know what, I didn't see this. You know, once the person is dead, they're dead. You cannot bring them back to life. And I think that is a very severe step to take about a person. And I don't believe we should have the right to take that life from anyone.
Once again, thank you for spending a few minutes with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Alexia.
Deborah Gonzalez is the new District Attorney of the Western Judicial Circuit. Coming up after the break, Representative Spencer Fry on the 2021 legislative session.
I'm Tim Franks. From the biggest breaking stories of the day to the important issues and trends, we're there.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. He will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Another huge development.
Join me and my colleagues for NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. State lawmakers were back at work this week in a legislative session that looks to be contentious and dominated by the coronavirus pandemic, redistricting, possible new restrictions on voting, and of course, the state budget. Earlier this week, I spoke with Representative Spencer Fry, an Athens Democrat, on his way to the Capitol. Here's our conversation. On the state budget, this is the one thing that legislators are constitutionally mandated to do. Do you foresee budget cuts, and what specific areas?
Our initial work will be focused on readjusting the mid-year budget to make sure that we predicted our revenues properly last year when we approved this budget, and to reallocate funds as needed in the departments. The governor has indicated that there will be he's not asking for any budget cuts. We do get tax revenue reports, and the revenues seem to be doing okay.
Republicans control both chambers of the General Assembly as well as the governor's mansion. Do Democrats have any power or leverage in the redistricting process?
You know, redistricting has another word, and that's called gerrymandering. And gerrymandering is the term for when a party that's in power will draw districts to maintain that power. It takes away the people's right, and I really feel like this should be addressed with an independent, apolitical commission like other states do. The objective of redistricting as a law is to make sure that the districts have similar proportional populations. As Georgia populations grow, as the rural populations shrink, those lines will have to change to maintain those same number of citizens to meet the citizen one vote representation rules that we like to follow. It's going to be tough. We'll know more at the end of the year when the census gets out and probably have a special session for redistricting.
Georgia has one of the lowest rates of vaccine distribution in the country. What do we need to be doing to improve that? Now, I do know that there is a lag time in reporting the actual vaccinations from providers to the CDC, so that does play into it as well.
We need to get those numbers up. You know, we had the same issues with the infrastructure, with the state of Georgia, with the testing, same issues with the infrastructure, with the state of Georgia are occurring with the vaccines. And we are not going to solve this pandemic problem unless we get creative. I do not believe that you can think you're going to passively get out of this pandemic. We have to take tests and the vaccine to the people. The mayor and commission of Athens Park County has been very aggressive and very forward-thinking and partnering with organizations to create mobile clinic units. That has been an incredibly successful venture. And if we don't get the vaccine to underserved populations, this is never going to change. That's how I'm trying to push this policy at the state level and show, I mean, we have the history of the 1918 pandemic, and you want to know how they got out of that? They put the vaccines on the trucks, and they drove around every neighborhood, and they vaccinated every single person they saw. We have to be active, we have to be creative, or else this will be here for the rest of my lifetime.
You know, those COVID-19 numbers are still skyrocketing. What can the state government do, or what do you hope the state government will do to pursue legislation to further prevent the spread of coronavirus, such as mask wearing or gatherings?
You know, it doesn't look like they're going to do too much more. I feel like the state has had 9 months to come up with policies and react to this pandemic, and I feel like we have reached the level of response that we will have. Unfortunately, the pandemic has been turned into a political tool. We've seen that locally. We see that with the surrounding counties. And it's amazing to me that science and research is basically being thrown out the window, and people refuse to acknowledge that this pandemic is real still to this day. And let me just leave you with this, because I'm from Mississippi originally. Speaking to my family in Mississippi, even Mississippi has a mask mandate. You cannot go anywhere in the state of Mississippi without a mask. And why Georgia is failing to implement rules that will protect the citizens, I have no idea, except for the indications are that this is political, and you can't fight a pandemic with politics.
Moving on to the topic of police reform, according to 11 Alive News, nearly one-tenth of the bills introduced before this session focus on police reform, which comes after a summer of worldwide protests prompted by police brutality. The response from law enforcement also drew criticism from some. Can you give our listeners an idea of what's currently on the table for Georgia lawmakers when it comes to police reform?
Well, that's a great question, and I can only speak to what I think. I have not studied the bills that were pre-filed yet. This is when legislation, we're still sifting through what we have in front of us. We all know that there needs to be a reform of some sort, and I think there's ways that we can do this based on best management practices in other areas of the country. There's organization that partners with the police. It's a third-party organization, and they go out to calls, and if there's mental health issues, then they are able to step in before the police arrest an individual and just stick them in jail. We've seen this issue in the state of Georgia, where we have basically abandoned our mental health facilities and used our jails as our mental health treatment centers. And if we can divert the folks that need mental health help out of the jails, we save money that way. The data on this program shows that they took 20% of the police call at a cost of only 3% of the police budget. Now, I would propose that that remaining 17% could be given to the good police officers. We all know that there are good police officers, and we all know that there are bad, but we need to figure out a way to cull the bad ones and reward the good ones. Also, I'm a firm believer in the fact that we should do bias testing. There are psychological tests that have been proven for many years that we can offer to people, and it will give you a statistically significant measure of a bias. We need to start training our officers a little better, a little more, and let them understand and institute these bias trainings in that, and I think we would have better outcomes for everybody.
Can you give us an idea of what changes to voting laws have been proposed and what impact these changes could have on future elections?
Yes, that's a big one. Again, it's early in the session. We have not seen, or I have not seen, any written legislation. I'd like to see us thread a needle on this issue. First and foremost, that we should not in any way reduce an individual's opportunity to vote. But the needle we want to thread is how can we offer people the feeling of security. Now, I say the feeling of security because the elections are already secure. We have gone through extensive research with federal and state officials in our own state. What we need to do is offer our citizens a sense of security that their votes can be made and that they are being made the way they want them. And the key will be not to reduce anyone's access to the ballot.
Once again, we're hearing talk that legislators may take up some form of legalized gambling, perhaps sports betting or casino gambling. Now, this has come up in the legislature a number of times in recent years. Does some form of legalized gambling have support in the General Assembly?
Personally, I feel like that legalizing gambling is a shortcut for short money, running, quick cash. I would much rather see us invest in our populations, invest in our public schools, invest in our technical colleges, and that to me is the long game on how to create a prosperous state. Quick money is always attractive, but the truth is if we don't invest in our children and their education, and our teachers who are teaching them, and invest in our society in general, the quick money is going to be painful money, and you're going to make it, it's going to cost you more in the end. And so I'm not particularly a fan of the quick money. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I don't have a moral judgment against it. I just feel like it's the wrong thing that we're focused on. Personally, if we raised the minimum wage in the state and gave people more money in their pockets, that would be the quickest way that we would have an economy grow. Georgia has one of the lowest minimum wages across the nation. We still are allowed to pay farm workers $5 an hour. Federal minimum wage is $7.25. If you do the math, that's $14,000 a year.
Wow.
No one in this society, in this day and age, can live anywhere for $14,000 a year. And we need to focus on the citizen rather than the quick cash.
Representative Spencer Frey, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and y'all stay safe.
WUGA supports the educational mission of the University of Georgia. Internships are available each semester in radio programming, production, news, and social media for students currently enrolled in college-level study. Information at WUGA.org or 706-542-3324.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. This week marks the 60th anniversary since Charlene Hunter Gault and Hamilton Holmes made history by becoming the first Black students to attend the University of Georgia on January 9th, 1961. Here to talk about that historic moment with us is Dr. Michelle Cook, the Vice Provost of Diversity and Inclusion and Strategic University Initiatives, who also holds a doctorate in history from Duke University. Dr. Cook, thank you for giving us a few minutes today.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you give us a little bit of historical context surrounding UGA's integration?
Well, yes. As many people may be aware, in 1961, the University of Georgia was officially desegregated as a result of a legal battle that allowed Charlene Hunter Gault and Hamilton Holmes to matriculate as the first African-American students at the University of Georgia. This was part of ongoing efforts by many folks. It also was not an easy battle. Even at the point at which these two students were allowed to matriculate, they were definitely met with some amount of hostility on campus that at one point resulted in a riot on campus that forced the institution to basically suspend them for their own safety and send them home. It is also important to note that later in that year, in May of 1961, Mary Frances Early, upon seeing the situation that her Turner High School colleagues were in at the University of Georgia, decided to transfer from the University of Michigan to UGA to complete her graduate studies. She was successful, and she was able to then integrate the University of Georgia Graduate School.
What can you tell us about Charlene Hunter Gault and Hamilton Holmes? Why were they selected to be the ones who would integrate UGA, and what were some of their experiences like?
As history records it, it was a very intentional effort in terms of identifying individuals and particularly students who would be appropriate and good candidates for the integration efforts. In other words, students who were academically gifted, students who were kind of beyond reproach, if you will. Because at this point, often at institutions, and UGA was among those, there was also this kind of moral imperative that it wasn't just a matter of academic capacity, but there was the tendency to look at the background of a student and their behaviors and their actions. And so these two young people were students who were specifically good candidates for this integration effort.
I know it's hard to get into UGA now, but they had to be perfect. They had to set an example for the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's
Absolutely.
A heavy burden on a college kid.
It really, really is. That they were able to navigate this with such success is really a testament to them as and their fortitude and their intellectual capacity, as well as emotional capacity as young people.
And what would you say were the attitudes of students, parents, and faculty at the time?
It is really interesting because, you know, on these issues, what we find is it's mixed. They stepped out in a moment of our history where the common attitude was that institutions such as the University of Georgia shouldn't be integrated. But I think what they found is that in the midst of quite a bit of hostility, they also met and were rewarded with strong support, often from unexpected corners of the institution. Definitely there were students who had the moral fortitude and the courage themselves to support them and to befriend them. There was also other members of the community. Miss Early speaks specifically of the religious community that really wrapped his arms around her. And then, of course, there were the faculty. What we find after Charlene and Hamilton were suspended is that the faculty stood up. The faculty wrote an open letter with numerous signatures, really supporting and asking if not demanding that they be reinstated. This was something where we see what we like to think of as the University of Georgia, and that spirit of inclusion and of opportunity and access really beginning to bud in their experience as people stood up to support these students.
Dr. Michelle Cook is the Vice Provost of Diversity and Inclusion and Strategic University Initiatives. Thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me.
So it's official. Georgia has two Democratic U.S. senators, and those two hard-fought wins give Democrats control of both the U.S. Senate and the House. But as WUGA's Devins Wald reports, that doesn't necessarily mean smooth sailing for the Biden-Harris agenda.
Georgia Democrats did more or less the impossible and elected two senators, securing the trifecta, that is, control of both the House of Representatives and the Senate, in addition to the executive branch. So it should be smooth sailing for the Biden administration, right?
Absolutely not. The Senate is rarely smooth sailing for anybody but the filibuster-proof majority.
That's Anthony Madonna, an associate professor of political science at the University of Georgia. He's sometimes called the Senate Whisperer because of his expertise on congressional politics and procedure. I spoke with Madonna about hurdles Democrats could face. The first, the U.S. House of Representatives, which, for all the talk about the Senate, might be a bigger challenge for Democrats.
This is a really narrow House majority. There are a number of conservative Democrats that are going to have a great deal of influence there. The Senate, I think, is going to be a difficult place, but I think the House is also going to be an exceptionally difficult place. The question is going to be, will they have simple majorities? Certainly for a number of big ticket progressive items, right? The Green New Deal is not likely to get a majority in this House. Things like voting rights, depending on how the bill is drafted, will have a little bit more difficulty than it had this past cycle. Statehood for a number of, Puerto Rico, for DC, certainly possible, but it will be tougher to get that simple majority. To the extent that Joe Manchin poses problems for the Senate, there's going to be at least 8 conservative Democrats in the House that will pose similar problems for Speaker Pelosi.
Speaking of a narrow majority, Democrats and Republicans will each hold 50 seats in the Senate. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris breaks the tie in the event of a 50-50 vote, thus giving the Democrats control. Barely. Like in the House, some conservative Democrats in the Senate could put the Biden administration in a tough position. In reference to Biden's appointees, Madonna says,
yeah, they should be able to kind of bypass the filibuster on most of these, and I would expect that this is going to give him a lot more leeway in getting those appointees in. And now it just depends on, all right, what does Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, John Ossoff, who are going to be fairly conservative Democrats, I assume, think about those nominees. You're going to need that simple majority, and you don't always get that. Manchin has defected, I think, 25% of major votes last Congress from the Democratic position.
For context, Joe Manchin is a Democratic senator from West Virginia, where nearly 70% of the state voted for Donald Trump in 2020. Kyrsten Sinema is a senator from Arizona, where Joe Biden eked out a win by fewer than 11,000 votes. And John Ossoff? You've probably heard of him. But it's not just about narrow majorities. There's also this.
But before that happens, I've got a few things I want to say to this body. And as a matter of fact, I'm not going to leave this body until I do get them said.
President, will the Senator yield?
The Senator yields.
No, sir, I'm afraid not. No, sir.
That's the infamous filibuster. Although Madonna says that it's not really an accurate representation of how filibusters really work. Actually, filibusters are difficult to identify. But the important thing to know is a 60-vote majority is needed to end one. This process is called cloture. And in recent years, cloture has been enacted significantly more often, according to Senate.gov. This is in part because obstruction or filibusters are occurring more often, but it is also because the majority party has started to believe it beneficial to challenge obstructions, leading to more motions for cloture, according to Madonna. The bottom line is,
filibuster is the threat, and so for a lot of legislative priorities like that, I think progressive groups have been championed, it's unlikely that they'll get through the Senate. And even apart from the Senate, I think a lot of people are also sleeping on just this small House majority, right? This is a really small House majority. So after I think Ossoff and Warnock won, there's a ton of focus on Joe Manchin, who's probably gonna be the swing vote in the Senate. But again, like with the very narrow majority now Democrats holding the House, I wouldn't be overly confident that a lot of these proposals would be getting out of there to the extent that they did last Congress.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Devin Swald.
In late June of 2020, we talked to Dr. John Drake, director of the Center for Ecology of Infectious Diseases, on using disease surveillance data to create accurate models for predicting the spread of infectious diseases. Today, Dr. Drake is here to join us to discuss the current COVID-19 models the center is working on and what that means for the public as they see a vaccine rollout. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So to start with, can you talk a little bit about how accurate the center's COVID modeling has been over the past few months since our last discussion in June?
So in general, we think that our models are pretty reliable in the short term. So over a period of 2 to 4 weeks out, we think they give a good picture of the trajectory of the epidemic. I think any model is unlikely to be very reliable for much longer timeframes than that. A group called the Forecast Hub has actually been compiling models from many different research groups and averaging those results. We know that the CDC is publishing those average results and relying on them for their own predictions. Our model is part of that ensemble.
Looking forward, what do the center's projections tell us about the future? I mean, do you see the pandemic having a definitive end, or do you think there'll be permanent adjustments made to our lifestyles for years to come?
Well, both. I think that there will be permanent adjustments. I think that the coronavirus is going to be endemic in our population. Whether or not we need to routinely get vaccinated for it remains to be seen. But that doesn't mean that the pandemic will be going on forever. I think that the pandemic will end. The vaccines that are coming out, however, are hugely important in preventing death and severe disease from that from this tail end of the pandemic. I strongly encourage everyone who has the opportunity to receive a vaccination to get one, and as soon as is feasible. In the short term, however, I am dismayed about the current situation. There is a lot of transmission out in the community, and without protective behaviors like mask wearing and social distancing, we can expect to continue to see cases rise.
Well, you mentioned the vaccines, and of course, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are being rolled out across Georgia and the country with some variable success. What do the center's models tell us about when we can see a reduction in cases and deaths with the current rate at which the vaccines are being distributed?
So as I said, in the short term, I think that we're probably likely to see both continue to increase. Our model shows that there are about 60 new cases per day per 100,000 people. This could double by mid-February if people aren't more careful. We are working to incorporate vaccine distribution in our model. Right now, we don't actually know the extent to which vaccines inhibit the transmission of the disease. The clinical trials that were used to approve the two vaccines that we have now, we're looking at their ability to prevent severe disease and death. A vaccine that confers sterilizing immunity prevents a person from being infected. We don't yet know whether or not these vaccines provide that sterilizing immunity, or if they provide a partial immunity that will reduce transmission, even if it doesn't prevent it altogether.
How has the pandemic changed perhaps how infectious disease models are produced in the first place and communicated to the public?
Usually we think of modeling as an academic exercise that we apply after the fact to try and understand what happened. With COVID-19, we've really been trying to use models to understand what's going on around us in real time. I don't believe that models should be used to tell us how to make our decisions. I think models are really an information tool. I like to think about model-aided decision-making. But in order for models to aid decision-making, those models also have to be presented to decision-makers. One of our goals is to better understand what are the decisions that are would be most informed by model-based information, and what kinds of information do those decision-makers most need?
Well, just fantastic information. Dr. John Drake is a distinguished research professor and associate dean for academic affairs at UGA, as well as the director for the Center for the Ecology of Infectious Diseases. Thanks so much for dropping by Athens News Matters today.
Thank you, Chris.
An All Things Considered story starts with the news.
Two women set to become the first female Army Rangers ever.
That day, we wanted to follow it with a conversation from a woman who was in the military.
So we just email everybody.
Whittle it down to one. We get her on the phone.
Welcome to the program, Sergeant Marquez.
Thank you very much, Audie.
I want to start just with your reaction.
There's more to every story on All Things Considered every afternoon.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Even though local music venues have been shuttered for nearly a year, that hasn't stopped local musicians from doing their work, and 2020 saw a number of notable local record releases. Our critic at large, John Slights, gives us just a few of the high points.
Let's be honest. 2020 was a year many of us would like to forget.
COVID-19, an economic collapse, a heated presidential election. It was a year that saw more than its fair share of tribulations. But in the midst of all that chaos, many Athens bands and artists released some of the finest albums and singles of their careers. It was a year of great albums and great reissues.
I'll drive to the ocean I'll drive.
The year began on a high note, with REM frontman Michael Stipe making his long-awaited return to the music industry with the single Drive to the Ocean. It's a low-key, atmospheric song that's reminiscent of some of REM's best latter-day tracks. Released on his 60th birthday, Stipe's voice is still as good as ever.
Surfacing, crowning, we blast right through history's...
That same month, Athens legends of Montreal returned with their first album in nearly 2 years, You're Fun. The album is fresh and modern, with a shiny gloss to it, a contrast to earlier of Montreal classics, such as Cherry Peel and the Gay Parade, which tended to be more lo-fi affairs.
When you're laughing, I hate myself. When you're upset, I love myself. When you're easy, I hate myself. When you're hard to get. In this strange existence, everybody's hit with so much pain in society.
You're listening to Gypsy That Remains. It's a danceable, groovy track from Your Fun. The lyrics contrast the upbeat sound. I love myself when you're gorgeous. I hate myself when you go mad, writes singer Kevin Barnes. In February, the Athens Cultural Affairs Commission issued a limited edition vinyl showcasing some of the city's finest hip-hop talents. Entitled Classic City Wax Volume 1, the compilation featured 12 tracks highlighting the Athens rap scene, including selections from local rappers Sun Tzu, King Blanco, Lingua Franca, and the track you're hearing now, Serenity, by Caulfield featuring Retro Thief.
So I thought you gave me more, so much more. Gave me serenity.
You gave me serenity to accept the things I can't change. Gave me courage to change the things I can. Gave me wisdom to know the difference. Know the difference.
September saw the release of Vampire Hours, the much-anticipated sophomore effort from the Hums. 10 years had passed between the release of Lemonland, the band's critically acclaimed debut, and Vampire Hours, but upon hearing the raucous opener Lady Low, it soon becomes abundantly clear that it was worth the wait. That's Miss No One, the epic 8.5-minute track. It begins as a down-tempo introspection, swimming in psychedelic atmospherics, until about 7 minutes in, when it morphs into a distorted sludge rocker. Yeah. 2020 also saw several great reissues from Athens legends. Perhaps the most notable reissue came in November with the release of the 4-disc, 47-track Pylon Box. Gathering two of the band's most beloved studio albums, Gyrate from 1980 and Chomp from 1983, it adds two additional discs, Extra, a collection of B-sides, rarities, and live tracks, and Raz Tape, which documents the band's first recordings from 1979. A 216-page hardbound book with essays from contemporaries such as Kate Pearson from the B-52s and members of REM is also included in the box.
We'll be right back.
November also featured the release of an album from another Athens legend. Randall Bramblett's Pine Needle Fire instantly became one of the finest works of his long and storied music career. It's an eclectic 12-song collection featuring ballads, bluesy numbers, psychedelics, and even vintage-sounding Southern soul, such as this track, Lazy and I Know It.
Dust has for 3 months, coast for nine. Catch me in a nightclub closing time. Mama said someday, baby, you got to stop your messing around. Yeah. It's not that I'm above it. The daily grind, lucky and I know it. So never mind me.
Overall, 2020 was an absolutely insane year. However, that did not stop some of Athens' best musicians from releasing and reissuing some of the finest music of their careers. Despite the craziness of the world around us, it's quite reassuring to know that the music still goes on in Athens. For Athens News Matters, I'm John Slights.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Gene Davis, Emma Turner, Lucas Trevor, Megan Wan, Devin Zwald, Jessica Wurst, and Isabella Liu. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
As always, you can listen back to today's stories and all of our stories on our website at WUGA.org or on the WUGA mobile app, available for Apple and Android. And of course, we'd like for you to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at WUGA-FM. For Chris Shoup, I'm Alexia Ridley, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News. We'll be back next week with more. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.